Okay, thank you. Thanks very much, Eberhard, and thank you again for having me here. It's a delight. So I will give a somewhat of an overview. You'll see that from this morning with Shimon, I'm going from the vast complexity of what happens in the real world. You'll see a very myopic, I'm afraid, view from the laboratory. So the work I'm going to be discussing is coming from two works that I've done with my students, one that just appeared and one that's in review. And I'll explain what I'm about in a moment. Just let me, well, first of all, the motivation, at least the primary motivation, is to get some understanding of entrainment with application to clouds. And I'm going to be dealing with just the effects of particle size and the effects of gravity in this, and I won't be dealing with a whole lot of the things that are really important in clouds, like evaporation, phase change, and so on and so forth. I'll explain again that in a few minutes. And of course, as you know, all of you know well already, that entrainment is a very, very important part of cloud physics, thermodynamics, and dynamics. And that in some clouds there's entrainment across the whole system, and in other clouds the entrainment is maybe mainly confined to the top, as in perhaps in stratocumulus clouds. And the turbulence issues, I have in mind warm clouds. The turbulence issues is, first of all, describing turbulence at the cloud scale, its sources, the effects of entrainment. Characterizing turbulence in the clouds is something that is not well done and not well understood. And there is a need for data in that direction. And there is a cross-cultural aspect to that, is to see whether the turbulence in the laboratory can mimic in any way the turbulence in clouds, that there are often these communities don't quite meet. The cloud communities tend to think that laboratories can't properly contribute to the subject. So I'm going to spend a certain amount of time talking about the overlap of parameter scales and parameters between the laboratory and the atmosphere. The other, of course, the big effects of turbulence is the effects of the small scale on the droplet growth, the effects of entrainment on droplet growth, and the linking of the fluid dynamics to thermodynamics. These are all immense subjects. And let me put some questions, and I'm afraid in red is the only little nibbles that I'm going to make into this problem is what I've put in red. So the first question is, are small-scale turbulence characteristics in clouds similar to laboratory turbulence? The next questions, type of question, does clustering enhance droplet growth? There's still a lot of controversy on that, and still a lot of work needs being done. What are the other effects of turbulence, effects of relative velocity on collision efficiency, and what are the effects of turbulence on collision growth and condensation growth? What are the relative effects of buoyancy and shear in clouds? How do the different entrainment mechanisms in cumulus and stratocumulus affect droplet growth? I haven't got a complete list of names here. This is very incomplete. What affects the width of the droplet spectrum? There are instrumental issues, there are data gathering issues, and there are almost personality issues on this subject. So these are very important. We have to understand really the tails of these distributions, and that's something that needs a lot of work. And then in red, what are the effects of entrainment on the droplet distribution is something that I'll be looking at, and of course on droplet growth, which I won't be looking at, and what are the effects of gravity on droplet distribution. So it's a very small little part, a sort of a reductionist approach to begin to look at some of these issues in the laboratory. And here, of course, again, I show something that after this morning's talk you'll realize is just one possible snapshot of hundreds of different snapshots that one can show of a cloud, and this is a taken from Raymond Shaw's review, an annual review of fluid mechanics, showing the velocity profile. But the things to note is, in fact, there is often shear at the edge of the clouds. This is the droplet concentration. So this is inside and outside the cloud. I'm not going to be including shear, and it'll become apparent why. That I'm trying to build up from simple cases to more complicated cases. And here are the mean droplet diameters, and again you'll see that this is only one possible picture that we could show. Droplet diameters can be smaller or larger than that, but as we've seen, even that they can vary across the cloud. So. But at least it sets the stage for the types of things that we see in clouds. The turbulence characteristics here, everybody knows these. I think I use a Taylor scale Reynolds number in clouds. Well, we'll come to that in a moment, but in clouds they're order of 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth, 10 to the fifth even. Taylor microscale is a small scale to giving the Reynolds number. Energy dissipation rate, usually in the lab we calculate from the derivative of the velocity, and it assumes that it's isotropic at the small scale. And of course, these important small scales of the turbulence, the dissipation rate going as e to the smallest Kolmogorov scale going as dissipation rate to the minus a quarter, and the time scale is epsilon to the minus a half. So these are things that we'll talk about. I'll say a few words. Nothing new about acceleration variance, but I will mention that later on. So the first question is what about the turbulence in clouds? And I've really pushed all of this onto one slide, and I'll spend a few minutes on it. But these are some really nice experiments that Raymond Shaw and Holger Siebert did with their group. And flew through stratocumulus clouds, and they had very, very clever ways of measuring with this. They didn't fly through, they had the helicopter dangling this contraption, this ACTOS, that went through very, very, very slowly with very good resolution, hot wire anemometry and so on, and a very clever method of getting rid of the droplets from the signal, and they got this wonderful data, and I worked with them to see if we could just put it into the form that people in the laboratory are familiar with in terms of looking at Eulerian turbulence statistics. And it's amazing that these statistics taken in a stratocumulus cloud are just so similar to what one measures in the laboratory. Not amazing. I mean, it's not amazing to me particularly, but it's important to point out, I should say, that these are so similar to what we're very used to seeing in the laboratory, albeit at lower Reynolds numbers. So this is the velocity kurtosis, the fourth moment of the distribution of velocity, and we know that at large scales the PDF should become Gaussian, and we know because of intermittency that at the small scales it grows. And these are typical values that are seen in the laboratory. One can use this relationship here, that assuming that the dissipation rate is log normally distributed, which they showed in these experiments to be the case, to get the intermittency exponent, which is a well-known way of describing the intermittency in small-scale turbulence. And they did that, and they got an intermittency exponent of 0.25, that should be a point, and this is exactly the same as more or less as what is found in the laboratory. And then they measured the structure functions up until eighth order using these extended self-similarity technique of Benzie to extract these exponents. And this is the K41 exponent, and these are the exponents that are measured in laboratory, and I think the cloud is one of these in the middle here. It doesn't matter much because the error bars on these things are fairly great. So the first important point that I make is that these experiments that were done really confirm, and I think for the first time, to this level of detail, dissipation statistics, structure function statistics, and so on. They really confirm that that these clouds, which of course have low particle loading, are really behaving just as we would expect. And that means that the implications for all sorts of other things that we can't measure in clouds are important. So we can't measure very well acceleration in clouds now. We can't measure a lot of things in clouds. But if we know these statistics in the laboratory, then we exist in the laboratory, then we can infer things about acceleration PDFs, infer things about clustering, infer things about many of the other statistics. So that this to me is a very important step in the right direction, and Raymond is now with his team doing cumulus clouds, I think, to the same level, or puffy shallow cumulus clouds, yes? So these are the parameters. Again, stopping time, you're all familiar with Stokes' number, but I'll be using two different settling parameters, one based on the Kolmogorov velocity and one based on the RMS velocity of the flow. So Stokes' number is comparing the stopping time to the Kolmogorov time, and the settling parameter is a gravitational parameter comparing the stopping velocity to the characteristic velocity of the fluid.
What does that mean on the bottom?
So then you can write if you have very large values of this. If this is large, if this is large, this is becoming very small, and it's becoming more like a quiescent flow. I'll talk about that a little bit more. So again, let me go a bit further talking about the clouds, and that is, these are again Raymond and Holger's measurements, showing the parameter space that they have. This is in a small cumulus cloud. This is the settling parameter based on the Kolmogorov scale. Here's the Stokes number, and the main thing is to see is that it's bunched up here in the Stokes number range, order 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, down to much smaller, and the settling velocities are order 1 to a tenth, and the particle sizes, if we've seen, you've seen many times here, are typically in this 10, 15, 20. Micron ranges, and the dissipation ranges, although many cloud people say, the dissipation is really low in clouds, it gets to quite high values. This is all in SI units. So here is some more data from Raymond's group, stratocumulus, cumulus, and just showing the variation. And again, it's the same scale as before. So these are measurements that at least we have pretty good ways of looking at what the parameters that exist in clouds are. So now I come to my talk, and I'm going to talk about wind tunnel experiments of looking at some of these aspects. And I'm going to look at entrainment. I'm going to explain this in some detail. We have a wind tunnel here with a grid here. We have sprays and a complicated grid setup. And we have a flow down here. We have an active grid here. This is now looking down the wind tunnel. We have an active grid here with sprays spraying out water droplets, generating very high Reynolds number turbulence. Then we have a screen at the bottom here, blocking off making the drag and the flow about the same as the drag here. So the mean velocity coming out of this thing is constant. This is spraying in water into high turbulence. This is low turbulence with no water, and there's an entrainment region across here. It's quite a little show to get going. I know many of you have seen this, but I know a lot of you haven't seen these active grids. So the active grid, if it works, which we've had working for now 15 years, this type of active grid, first developed in Japan by Makita in the early 90s, and then there are now maybe half a dozen in the world. And I point out that this is Mark 1 and this is Mark 2 that Eberhardt is building, where each one of these little blades is going to be activated independently. So here is the flow, and there are two combinations. One is that the picture I showed you with the active grid and the sprays coming in and screens here. The mean velocity is essentially constant because where the blockage is the same here. There's a splitter plate here. The RMS is not constant. Follows roughly an error function, and there's turbulence on this side. Turbulence with droplets and no turbulence with no droplets here. But then we did, and we call this the turbulent non-turbulent interface, but we also did a case where we've got a turbulent-turbulent interface, exactly the same as here, but we had an active grid all the way through, spraying up here, so that the RMS velocity is the same across. No shear. Okay, so there is the simple system. And what we did then, what we can do is rotate all of this for different experiments. So here we've got the active grid and the sprays above. We can just change the whole thing around and have the active grid and the sprays below, or we can rotate it by 90 degrees. And so we can completely change the effects of gravity on the flow. This is a smoke visualization from experiments that I did a long time ago now, just using passive grids, but it's exactly the same flow. And so here is the homogeneous, what I'm going to call the homogeneous turbulence regions above. Here's the laminar, in inverted commas, region below, and you've got these very strong gusts of turbulence penetrating into the entrainment region. Then you turn the tunnel upside down, or the system upside down, and you've got now the water droplets here and the laminar flow here. G is acting down in both cases. So here you've got G aiding entrainment. Here you've got gravity hindering it. And then we did it on the side, and so G is acting in 90 degrees to the direction in which the entrainment is working.
No stratification, right?
No stratification, and
so
this
only matters for mechanics of
droplets. The mechanics of the droplets, and you'll see it has a very profound effect. No stratification, no phase change, no convection, no nothing. I mean, it really is a very, very bare bones.
But you showed that if you inject droplets that they partially evaporate, you do not have a temperature gradient.
I'll come to the droplet distribution in a minute. Our smallest droplets evaporate. We did the calculations and actually measured and so on. The very smallest one, like below 5 microns, evaporate. Okay. So, in fact, you talked about stratification. So, I mean, stratification, as we saw this morning, we see every talk, is fundamental to clouds. This is the same flow I just showed you before, with G acting in this way, and this is where we did this same experiment, put a very strong temperature lid on this. It completely cuts out the whole of this. So everything I'm going to say is about this, and probably much that is relevant in this subject is about this. But it's sort of one step at a time. So what I thought I would do is talk about what we know about the homogeneous region, and I'll go through some results that many of you know already, and then I'm going to talk about the entrainment region. So I want to talk about what happens to particles in the homogeneous region, and there is a lot of literature on this. The literature that Eberhardt and others really got the inertial particle subject, at least got me interested in, many others is this, and then we've done experiments on inertial particles, and I'll show you them. There is the clustering work, which is really related to the inertial particle work of again Shaw, Collins, and many people in this room. And then there is the settling particle velocity that occurs in the presence of gravity. And the players in this are a slightly different group of people, and I'll pay some attention to that. So first I'll talk a little bit about old ground of what happens to inertial particles in homogeneous turbulence, and then I'll talk about these newer, rather curious results that we have. So here's the particle distribution that we measure from these droplets, and you can see I mean these are quite comparable to what we would see in the clouds that I talked to you before. Oh, I'm not exactly sure about the distribution, but at least the mean values are fairly comparable. And what we do is we've been the results. Sometimes we'll talk about the whole distribution, but sometimes we'll talk about the small particles, which really is the bulk of things. And then I'm going to talk about these large, very large particles as well. So you'll have to be a little bit patient. These are numbers, but again, they're important to talk about. So in the clouds that you saw before, the Reynolds number is high, 1,000 to 10,000. Stokes number is 10 to the minus 1 to 10 to the minus 4. Settling parameter is 1 to 10 to the minus 2, and epsilon is 0.1 to 10 to the minus 4. These are to remember. In our experiment, on our average for the whole distribution, our Stokes number is 0.2, okay, so it's at the upper end. Our settling velocity is 0.54, which is at the upper end, but still in the range that you see in clouds. And our epsilon is 0.14, again, which is at the upper end. So all of these things, excepting for the Reynolds number, is quite comparable. And then when we break it down into our small, intermediate, and large droplets, you can see that we can look. These are independent particles. They're not interacting with each other, so it's quite valid to do this. So that we're getting very small Stokes number for the small particles, and small settling velocities, and so our small particles really indeed are very much in the range of the cloud. The effect of Reynolds number, of course, is to exaggerate any of these complex effects like clustering and so on. So anything that we find in the laboratory will be amplified in clouds because the Reynolds number is higher. The tails of distributions get wider and so on and so forth. So that's sort of emphasized. It's a way of saying that what we if we're finding important effects in the laboratory, then these will be amplified in real clouds. So the first important effect is quite a fairly old result, is looking at the acceleration PDF of the inertial particles, and these are Stokes numbers of around 0.1, and here are Eberhardt's original results of fluid particles, and what happens is that if you have inertia, there is a selective sampling of the fluid, and the tails become attenuated, and this has been nicely verified by DNS with Federico and others, so these results are now on quite firm ground, and it's a sort of a very basic result. And again, let me emphasize, if in clouds you could measure acceleration PDFs of the droplets, a typical Stokes number, you would see these very, very wide tails, but I think we're a fair away from getting there at this point. The way we measured that, again, this is for the people, a lot of people here know this, but this was a lovely system that Armand Gilferson built and still works at Cornell for measuring that. To do the Lagrangian is that we have a light sheet and we have a sled with a camera, so the sled moves at the speed of the mean flow, and so we can extract the droplets, which you can see skimming past this this laser sheet, we can extract the droplet motion from the mean motion and get the Lagrangian tracks. So that was, and again, this is something that Eberhardt is now constructing in his own laboratory, and he'll be able to get to 10 to the fourth Reynolds numbers. Related to clustering is preferential concentration that again has received a lot of attention. This is an early DNS by Reed and Collins, where they put in inertial particles and then turn on the turbulence, and the regions of high vorticity become vacant, and the particles collect at the regions of high strain. So this is again another established result, but as I said at the beginning, it's not quite clear how what the implications are for raindrop growth at this point.
Because with gravity it would be a different result. I think there's no gravity.
There's no gravity in there. I mean, these are small scale accelerations, and I'm not sure that gravity is going to have such a profound effect on the tails of these distributions. But it could. This is with gravity. This is an experiment in Eaton's group at Stanford. Okay, and so in fact, Raymond came to Cornell and put his equipment in our wind tunnel and measured clustering under roughly the same conditions, a little bit higher droplet concentration, and measured that this is a measure of the clustering, and he's measuring significant clustering as a function of Stokes number as you go to into the dissipation scales. So all of these things are pretty well established now in wind tunnels, and again, the argument is that since the type of turbulence that one sees in clouds is the same as you see in wind tunnels, then presumably all these things are happening in the clouds. Now, the next step is to look at the velocities of the particles. And there are a lot of people doing sedimentation, people that do lakes and so on, of course, are very, very involved with this. And there are a lot of different mechanisms by which the velocity of a falling particle can change due to the effects of turbulence. And one is this vortex trapping, which is an unlikely contender in the type of flows. This is very high vorticity flows where a particle could get tracked in a vortex. And as you can see, this is coming from the hydraulic literature. People are doing experiments mainly in water. And another well-established mechanism by Wang and Maxi, who have done direct numerical simulations, and their experiments that confirm this, is fast tracking, where the particle gets swept along dramatically by the vortices and increases their settling velocity relative to Stokes velocity. And there are DNS, there are models using, you know, sinusoidal vortices and so on and so forth that confirm this. And finally, there's something called a loitering effect. If you think of a particle not doing the fast track that we saw before, but coming down here, it'll spend more time in these regions here than in these regions here. And the net effect is that it can fall slower than the settling Stokes velocity. And here are some early experiments showing that is the case. And we confirm that for our heavy particles in a moment. So these are heavy particles in weak turbulence. So I'm only talking now about the homogeneous side of our flow, and these are the small particles, intermediate and large particles, and here is the settling velocity of the particles, an average settling velocity, or the settling velocity of these bin particles divided by the Stokes velocity as a function of the settling parameter. And you can see when you're getting to around 0.2 here, but around 50 microns or so, then in this flow, you're observing a reduction in the mean speed of the particles. So there's a lot of things that can occur for one particle distribution. I've listed some of the other studies here. I don't think it's worth going through these, but there are a number of other studies looking at these settling velocity experiments. I won't spend time on them. So,
could you go back?
Yeah.
So enhancement at low. So this reduction at high settling gravities is the loitering.
Loitering. Yeah. Okay. So this confirms very nicely those earlier experiments that we saw as well, so which were done probably with mud particles in water or something like that.
I've never seen it across such a wide range of scales.
Okay, so you'll see this affects
a power law.
That's a power law, and this is showing if you take away the normalization that the particle velocity is proportional to the RMS of the turbulence.
And it seems that power. So power one. Yeah.
Power one. Yep.
And can you indicate something like that at the reductions in the reduction rate?
No. I mean, this is the best data I've seen that my student took. It's still pretty scattered. Very, very few particles there, but still, it's very clear that it's going down. It's very clear. Okay, so these are other experiments to look at, but as I showed before, this is the earlier experiment of Nielsen, who's just getting a little mess here. Consistent with us here, but there's a mess here, so we seem to have cleared up that a little bit. Okay, so the Stokes number goes as epsilon to the half. The settling velocity is epsilon to the minus a quarter. There is, for reasons that I often don't understand, the meteorologists want to get rid of epsilon because they see that at least in laboratory work, that the epsilons are larger. De Villa and Hunt developed the model, and they talk about a particle Froude number, and they is ST times SV squared, and that's independent of epsilon. And they show for SV less than one and for FRP greater than much less than one, that the settling velocity is larger. And so we plotted their data, plotted it in their way as well. And it's roughly the same graph. It works out because we're in this homogeneous region that we did this, that it's only different by an integral scale and scaling parameters. But and so you get roughly the same thing. So let me now turn to the entrainment region. So I've come down from here, and I'm looking at this business here and here and here for the different cases. I'm going very fast now because I'm not being impeded for some reason. So when we move into this entrainment region, as I said, we have two cases, one in which we have turbulence and no turbulence, and another one, which wouldn't make much of a photograph, of turbulence and turbulence. So the turbulence and no turbulence is the TNI case, and here are the hot wire anemometry. For the TTI, it's constant. The turbulence level is across that. For the TNI, of course, the turbulence drops, and these are the U and V components. You don't have to worry about that. And of course, in the middle of this, you get very strong non-Gaussian statistics in the velocity field. Don't worry about that. It's roughly the same graph but with the dissipation rate put in. This is the dissipation rate being high, of course, on this side and very low on the other side. So that's something that you'd expect, and it's something that we measured many years ago looking at this. It's a fundamental flow because it's in fact what's called a shearless mixing layer. It's not in the canons of turbulent flows. The canons of turbulent flows are boundary layers, jets, wakes, and mixing layers, where you have two streams, one going faster than the other. And that's the one you pick up any Townsend's book, any of these books on turbulence, Pope's book, they go through all of these flows. But in some sense, this is one of the reasons we chose to look at it. It's a more fundamental flow because it's only turbulence-turbulence interactions. There's no mean shear. And so it's all governed by the turbulence. So all the transport and so on are due to third order transport terms of the U component of velocity, V component of velocity transferring kinetic energy. So UV squared terms. There's no shear production. So it's really, I would argue, a much more fundamental flow than these canonical flows that are used in the textbooks. And it's a flow that is a realistic flow as well. So there it is there with its high kurtosis. As it happens, you can model it quite well with an error function. And this is an error function. This is the test section. It's not perfect, but it's not bad. This is the test section here where we're measuring. This is upstream, and then this is downstream. And Garrett has put he's allowed for the decay of the turbulence in the downstream correction, and his direction has fitted a nice error function to it. Here are the spectra as you go across the flow. It's a little less nice than I've advertised. Here it is in the high turbulence side. This is in an energy form. It's multiplied by k, so you get that. It's been normalized, but it's essentially in kinetic energy units. And so you've got a spectrum like this, and going from the high side to the low side, there's a little bump that really doesn't look very nice at all if you plot it in this way here, but there it is down there. But it's quite clear that the turbulence is much lower. You saw that particularly from the energy graphs. Now, the first result is that without gravity, all of the particle, first result is without gravity, all of the particle concentration profiles fit on each other for a particular flow. So here is the TNI, the turbulent non-turbulent interface, and here is the spray side, and we're going across the flow at a particular cross section, and this is the particle concentration normalized by the particle concentration on the injection side. And so of course the particle concentration falls off as you go into the non-injection part of the flow. And of course you would realize that it has to be that if there's turbulence on the other side rather than no turbulence, then the turbulence is going to be much more effective, and so that you get further penetration for the turbulent flow. But so these are obvious things, and the main other point is that all particles in a non-gravitational field behave the same way. So that this is no gravitation. So I've got the entrainment now going across in this direction, and the gravity is acting in this direction. I mean, there are subtle effects of gravity, but to first order, it's not important. And so these are different, small, large, and medium size, and there's a bit of scatter here. We've got other results that show that we've carefully checked that. We don't see any reason that they are falling any differently when it's non-gravitation. You can think of the left-hand side of the cloud or the right-hand side of the cloud.
No, I just wanted to check if I do understand properly.
And for the concentration profiles, for the TTI, for the turbulent-turbulent interface, again, I'm not going through all the details. There's a nice fit of an error function for that. But of course, for the TNI, it doesn't fit an error function. But we can fit a modified error function with a variable diffusivity as you move across the flow, and so you can fiddle with it and get a reasonable fit, which would be useful for modeling purposes. Okay, so when you have gravity now, the situation is completely different. This is now the turbulent interface, okay, again for the first order is that the turbulent interface is protruding further into the non-injection side than the turbulent non-turbulent interface.
The gravity, so you have droplets above.
So now this is two cases now. Droplets coming from above and droplets coming from below. And I'll explain each one. So this here is large particles. Okay, the large particles which are above, I think 50 microns, I think I had 40 or 50 microns. And this is there. They've penetrated much, much further into the flow with gravity aiding entrainment. And the opposite case is the large particles with gravity hindering entrainment. It's exactly the opposite situation. And the bulk of the particles are behaving like the no gravity case here. Okay, so it's the large particles that are really strongly affected by the gravity. There are differences in the shapes. We've pinned these shapes at the end, and there's subtle differences, and more here. I don't think I'll go into it now. It's a little bit of hand waving. It's the same situation for the turbulent, non-turbulent interface. Of course, it falls off much more quickly, but it's the same. It's the same business. And these separations are order of Stokes type distances. Okay. The particle diameter now, if you look at the particle diameters as you move across these flows, so this is for the G plus, what we call gravity enhancing entrainment. This is the G minus gravity. This is the sprays at the bottom, gravity acting against it, and this is for the zero gravity case. And the clearly the and this is for the I'm getting mixed up here. I think that this is for the TTI, which is the most effective way of mixing it, and this is for the turbulent non-turbulent interface. But it doesn't matter what it is. Large particles are preferentially selected as you move across the flow, and it's quite clear in the PDF of the flow that you're getting these enhancement of these tails. So this is a really, you know, I would have thought a very important sort of result for the cloud people. I mean, you know, there's no evaporation, no condensation, no nothing really, but even without that, you're getting, not unsurprisingly, you're getting quite a change in the probability distribution as you go across the cloud. Now, things are quite subtle, that the mean velocity, this is the velocity of the particle now, divided by the RMS value in the injection side, and the velocity increases as you go across. This is now normalized by the RMS, not by the Stokes numbers I did before. And this is the large particle and the small particle, and there's a small difference between their velocities in the homogeneous turbulent side. That's a function of their Stokes numbers. But as you move across the flow, they tend to merge together, and indeed for the TNI case, they actually cross over, so that the large particles tend to be going slower, in fact, than the small particles. And a little bit of it is due to this difference in the profiles, that the large particle profile has got its abscissa shifted across the flow. A little
profile of what?
This is the concentration that I showed before. Okay, and a bit of it is due to possibly due to the loitering. But one of the main points to come out of this and some of the other statistics I'll show is that that most of this transport is happening inside the bursts. And all these bursts are going roughly, dragging everything at roughly the same speed. So here is the intermittency factor and the ratio of the burst time. So this is the velocity field. And so again, this is for the turbulent, non-turbulent interface. And so you have Gaussian on both sides, and then you have a a kurtosis in the middle, and then we have a little gating to look at intermittency. It's one if you've got full turbulence and zero if you've got no turbulence, and depending on the level that you set it, it varies. I'm not very interested in the details, but just the fact that we can use an intermittency factor to describe what's going on. Here is the seated region and the bursting region of the profiles of the particles, and then you can see that you've got these turbulence bursts. These are hundreds of bursts here, and then empty regions in between. Here is what we do when we condition then the particles on there, whether they're in a burst or not. This is the profiles we had before. This is for the turbulent non-turbulent interface and turbulent-turbulent interface. When you condition it of being in a burst, you can see that most of the particles are associated with the bursts. And the burst lengths are different for reasons that are not entirely obvious between the turbulent turbulent interface and the turbulent non-turbulent interface. The turbulent-turbulent interface has wider bursts than the turbulent non-turbulent. This then is when we condition. So this is the RMS profile. Then we condition the RMS measured of the particles. And we got the particles that are only in the bursts, and we get a similar profile. It's a bit of a mess, and I don't think terribly insightful. But again, it's another way of showing that most of the bursting is associated. Much of the transport and entrainment is associated, but not all of it is associated with the bursts. We looked at the droplet velocity as a function of separation. This is a little bit akin to clustering, and find that the speed increases greatly when you're at the small scales, again associated with the bursts. We've looked at, I'm hurrying through these because I don't want to go more than an hour. This is the RMS profiles across the flow, and what is interesting is that not only this is for the T turbulent non-turbulent interface, that you'd imagine that the particle velocity RMS will increase as you go across, but even for the turbulent turbulent interface it decreases as well. I don't know that I. And we've measured the kurtosis of these things. So this is broadly what we've done. I've come to my end. I'm rather pleased that you'll have a longer afternoon. but I think what we've done is really, it's a first step to isolate the effects of gravity and particle size. And clearly, even this very, very simple situation, there are really first-order effects that are there. The other thing I haven't added to this is that we've shown, you know, as I showed in the early part of this talk, is that all of this stuff that we're doing in the lab is really just around about the right parameter range that is occurring in clouds. It's not off the ballpark in any way. And if I've said it too many times, it's because there's a lot of skepticism in the community that the lab experiments can get the right parameter range. So we're going to put in shear. Shear is nearly always associated with entrainment, and we're actually doing that now, and we're sort of putting in shear in a gradual way, and just to see where we get a qualitative differences in the results. It's not a trivial thing to do, but we're doing that now, and I don't know that we'll get to doing the evaporative situation. It's a whole new ballpark to worry about phase changes and so on. And there is the person who really understood clouds and their complexity, and that's Constable. So I have no questions.
So I can comment. meteorologists do not like epsilon, since they do not measure it and have they have no crude idea
what it is, what's it about.
So this is why this kind of presentation of results, it's not very easy to go through.
Because it's not something I measure.
It's the same with their
probability density functions, that they think that the turbulence is Gaussian because they just measure the velocity.
It's a problem of communicating results and understanding how.
What do your own measurements have in the actual range from which you can extract that?
It's really tricky, since most of the measurements are made with fast aircraft. So it means that your resolution of if you have this five-hole probe in front of radome of Hercules aircraft, so you have roughly 10 meters resolution of velocity fluctuations. Okay, what you can trust. So you are in the upper part of inertial range and have no crude idea what's going down.
How about for the helicopter?
For the helicopter, so this is the first measurements that are very scarce, just few penetrations in clouds, and they are marvelous results. This Holger Siebert and Ryan and others are doing, but they are very limited and very fast. In very specific conditions.
It's hard to believe, nothing.
So this is really, really terra incognita.
So these are the results that he's referring to, that are so convincing that all of the turbulence that we know and love that occurs in the lab is occurring in the clouds. And the only way that will change in a cloud would be if you had enormously higher droplet concentrations, which, is not...
It's not the real case, yet.
Yeah. It's not the case, I would have thought.
Maybe higher droplet concentrations or closer to an active, something like what Shimon showed this morning.
Right.
There are strong gradients where there might be more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's real problem, and the second problem is, what is the real intermittency of turbulence in clouds, and not related to intermittency at very high Reynolds number when you produce it by shear, but at different sources and different mechanisms of turbulent kinetic energy production and unvecting to turbulent motions towards the regions of the cloud. Mm-hmm. So this is the real uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is why it's still not very easy to transfer this results, but it's marvelous what you are doing.
I only had a query about this turbulence interface. So when you say turbulence interface, that means they have different intensities of turbulence.
When I call it a turbulent interface, it's fully, it's just homogeneous turbulence, but it's only injected with droplets on one side.
Okay,
so it's a turbulent interface for the droplets. There's a splitter plate, so we're putting droplets in one side, but the turbulence below is exactly the same. Yeah.
So the results you've shown, how do they impact clouds?
The fact is, what do we learn about clouds? I suppose we have to understand more about what the entrainment mechanisms, the thermodynamic entrainment mechanisms.
The thermodynamic coupling is to that.
And then we'd have a better clue. I mean, that you've got evaporation and heat release and all sorts of things happening as well. But still you have gravity and still you have variable size particles. And we're saying, look, if you've got gravity and you've got various sizes of particles, then you're going to have preferential speeds and
pressure. Sorting mechanism across the interface, which sorts your size.
What you're basically saying is that if I'm in a certain region of a flow which is inhomogeneously mixed, mm-hmm. Turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
it's just a normal turbulence, but there's lots of particles, not very much particles. Then if I were to measure a particle size distribution function, it would look very different in the mixed region than it looks in the region, you know, in the mixed region.
Exactly.
And so the bigger guys are there.
The bigger guys will be there.
Your distribution function, your collision kernels for cloud droplet generation will look very different there because you have much larger particles there.
If gravity is acting in that particular way.
An important thing to note is that, you know, I remember the first time I read the paper that's in JFM. Mm-hmm. My first impression was that, okay, they discovered the gravity, you know, the large drops fall faster than small drops.
Everybody
is the real result. Yeah. But there's more going on than that. I think that's the message that needs to come through. There are dynamical interactions between these bursting actions and the motion of the droplets, which is non-trivial.
So the particle concentration, is it? You know, particles per cubic centimeter, is it roughly what you have in the cloud?
These are the particle numbers that we've counted.
So particle number, is
per,
the same?
Per unit
it's
volume.
It's the same.
Per unit volume. I've forgotten what the actual, it's there in our papers, but we've normalized, most of our results are normalized by what's happening in the seeding region. So it's one, and then we're looking
at the same density of particles.
For what? For the different?
For a cloud. Is the cloud as dense as your?
Oh, yes, it's comparable. To 10 to the minus, I forget the numbers, 10 to the minus 4 or something that we get. It is, do you remember, Raymond, the seeding density that we have is not that different. It's not that different. It's very low seeding density, comparable. I think it's 10 to the minus 4 that we have, but I've forgotten the units now. So would it be
interesting?
Minus 4 in some units.
I mean, if I now worry about
it's a physics department here, you know, so you don't have to worry about it.
So I'm asked, do we know? So if you go into the regime where you get the out droplet formation, okay? So in other words, in the regime where we know that cloud droplets get larger, right? What do we know about the effect of turbulence on that? Is there an effect of turbulence, or does everybody believe that turbulence, you know, particles that are of the size of a millimeter now, right? I'm not talking about the tiny guys anymore. I'm talking about the big guys that are falling through turbulence. Is the turbulence only, is it completely negligible? Probably not. Because you could.
You mean the effect of the droplets?
If I have really big particles, right? So let's say particles are really
big.
Then your Stokes number is large, right?
Yeah.
Right? If the Stokes number is larger, then preferential concentration would be strong. So these particles have a much larger probability to collide gravitationally because they get pushed into regions where they're dense. Isn't it? I mean, usually we argue that the first droplets get generated by preferential concentration, the first droplets have to hit, then you have a few big ones and they just fall. But they don't fall through something that's homogeneous, they fall through something that's turbulent. Mm-hmm. And that turbulent field, of course, produces preferential concentration also of the bigger guys. Why they are falling through the turbulence? Because the response of getting caustics, the response time is typically a Talida, right? So these particles very quickly figure out that they are in a highly turbulent flow, and the Stokes numbers are not low, they're actually large. So every time I hear people, they say, why do you worry about turbulence? You know, Stokes numbers are so tiny, so it should not be important. But is it really clear that it's not important for bigger things? And stopping evaporation, basically making really big particles much faster than you would get without turbulence?
Well, I mean, you know, Raymond has done a lot of work on looking at the effects of small and big particles on.
Well, I think
the growth of raindrops.
Some other people, Liang Ping Wang, and
it's a question actually. It's just I don't know.
Federico,
I mean, range
starting back. Some people have looked at large particles.
Yeah,
that's important.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But it's I've never seen that connected to clouds.
Oh yes, I mean I think people. And the thing is
it's not. The issue is the following.
The rain formation process, this is what I'm saying.
It's not rain formation already, but rain maintaining, let us say.
Yeah, rain maintaining.
Rain maintaining. So generally, I do not know papers about it, since usually, you know, rain shafts quickly get out of the cloud. So the typical mechanism to accelerate rail shaft down, this is what is beneath and what comes from the numerical simulations of clouds, is just a mass loading. And the second thing is evaporative cooling when the large droplets go through the air. If you see, for instance, Virga on our sky, sometimes you see clouds which are called cirrus ulcinus. It's not rain, but this is snow. These are just coma shape clouds on the sky, very very high, but very 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 bright. So you have a snow falling down, and snow crystals are evaporating during falling down, so their settling velocity decreases. So you see this comma shape when they are drifted with the wind. Their angle velocity changes, you know.
But well, you know, cloud is a few. I mean,
but
we're in a cloud. If I know too little about clouds. If I have a cloud that's a kilometer thick, yeah, right? Where's the rain actually initiated?
Yeah, at the top. So
clearly the Stokes numbers are large. So actually doing experiments, big oshis. It's big particles, not the little tights. You know, we work very hard to make them small. You know, the big ones is completely cautious.
Well, you know, these are big ones that we're looking at here.
50 microns. So these are big ones.
These are the ones that are having this.
This is more like drizzle, yeah.
Could you go to the fall speed plot that you showed, this power law?
So why,
I'm just a little bit surprised, why is it being scaled by the large end settling parameter?
So let me,
what's the logic?
And there is a, yeah, let me show you what the large, so it's, that's why I put that definition of, I hope I can find it. I've got to remind myself of, it's the eddy time scale for the sort of a Stokes time going over the distance of an eddy. So
why would you choose the large eddy, not the small one?
So that's been the tradition in this group. I can plot it against the small eddy. It's not clear to me what it will look like.
Or maybe it makes no difference.
Yeah, it's not quite clear to me what it'll look like. But it will. It won't change the abscissa at least. So I'll have a look at that.
So it's for, no change on the order of 10 to minus 1.
They argue that it's around 1. I mean, you know, it's a.
And these are from your measurements?
These are our measurements. These are all our measurements.
So you're looking at the vertical component of the velocity.
Right.
In your shear?
Only in the homogeneous region these are done. These are all done in the homogeneous region. We could look in the bursts at it as well. We should do that.
The transition is about falling velocity, rest falling velocity is comparable with the large scale.
Well, that'd be one, wouldn't it? That'd be one. Just to remind you about the droplet size distribution is for Eberhardt's. I've gone the wrong way. So these are these particles that are loitering. So that's above 40 micron.
So these are the ones that we keep up.
That what?
These are the ones where you see the big effects.
These are the ones where you see the big effects. The shifting of the concentration profile.
What's the Stokes numbers?
The Stokes numbers are of the large particles are
0.8. 2.
The other thing that I didn't emphasize is that when you don't have gravity, Stokes numbers are irrelevant in all of this. These bursts are just transporting everything in the same way. So it's the gravity that is doing everything. So and then when you don't have gravity, you can use a large scale Stokes number, which is very, very small. So the large scale Stokes, oh, I don't have it here. Yeah, here. It's 0.01, for example. Well, on the average for the whole thing is very, very small.
The expression of Stokes is about 1.
Mm-hmm.
The gravity is so strong that it induces the falling velocity comparable with...
It produces it.
The gravity is so strong that it induces a falling velocity which is comparable with the large scale velocity.
At about 1, yeah. It seems so, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.